Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Global Math Department. And that my name is Jessica Bogey, and I'm your host this evening. Tonight, we're going to hear from John Ray and all about our Formative Five and formative assessment and all of that fun stuff. I see a lot of you are in here already, ready to have some fun. People in here, which is great. We are excited to see, I see new people and some familiar names in there. So let's take some time right now to please introduce yourself in the chat window. Tell us what you teach, where you teach, and please make sure you share your Twitter handle if you have one so we can make connections after the webinar. Hope all of you that are on the East Coast are staying safe with the impending storm. Welcome, Daniela and Katie, or Kathleen and Julie. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for taking time to introduce yourself. And remember, if you have a Twitter handle, make sure you share it so you can make connections with people outside of our webinars. All right, so I'm going to get started here. Before I introduce and turn everything over to our speaker, let me explain just a little bit about how our math department, Global Math Department meetings work. The meetings are recorded and are typically available about 24 hours after our session ends. So if there was something you wanted to share with a colleague or you wanted to rewatch it later, all you have to do is come back to the same URL you came to this evening and or you can share that same link and you'll be able to watch the rewatch the webinar. So it allows you to share the recording with anyone. So you can share it with your math department or others in your district or other colleagues. The Global Math community prides itself on being friendly and supportive. So we do have the chat room available for topical and general conversation throughout the meeting. I will take time to catch your questions for our presenters, so don't worry that they won't notice it in that chat window. Our speaker tonight is John Ray, and it is all yours, John.
All right. Thank you, Jessica. Give me a smiley face if you guys can hear me, just somebody.
Yep, I can hear you just fine.
Perfect. Okay. Thanks, Jessica. It's an honor to be able to share with you tonight. And I want to thank all the organizers from the Global Math Department for this exciting opportunity to discuss the topic and spend time together learning how formative assessment can guide our planning, enhance our instruction, and even drive and improve student discourse and learning. And now I'm sitting here thinking, man, nobody told me about the favorite beverage thing, but I'll have to do with my bottled water here. So right out of the gate, I'm going to pose a question up here. I'd like to get each of you involved. And so take a minute or so to reflect on your response to what do you feel a teacher's role should be during collaborative student work? In other words, while students are engaging in solving meaningful math problems together, what do you feel we as teachers should be doing? And when ready, what I'd like you to do is type your responses in our chat area, and let's take a look at what people are thinking. Okay. Well, I did this recently. I actually did this recently during a session at my district's new teacher induction training a couple weeks ago for beginning, middle, and high school math teachers. So I work in Howard County Public Schools. That's in Ellicott City, Maryland. A lot of people like to think that it's roughly halfway between Baltimore and D.C. It's a little closer to Baltimore than D.C. Briefly, we're about a school system of about 58,000 students. We have 72 schools. We are kind of organized in, you know, pre-K to 5, 6 to 8 would be middle school, and then 9 through 12 high school. And so I'm working with these, you know, brand new teachers to Howard County, and using data from that word cloud, here's more or less where the responses were or the results were. So you guys know how word clouds or Wordle works, where you have, you know, the larger font words being ones that show up more in terms of their frequency. I have to say the results kind of struck me in a way that I never experienced before. Like, for instance, the word guide or even the word facilitator. Like, what I was struggling with was during collaborative student work, guide or facilitate what? And I'm actually thankful for their candid responses, and yet I was simultaneously challenged with the results. And to add some context, I should reveal that I entered the teaching profession in an era where teachers were taught to be a guide on the side and not a sage on the stage. However, when I looked up the dictionary definition of guide, it says to show or indicate the way to someone. And the definition of facilitator is one that makes an action or process easy or easier. So when you put those two together in the context of collaborative problem solving, you might have a recipe for actually low expectations, where learners are permitted to avoid engaging in deep levels of math reasoning and sense making. So maybe I'm overthinking this at this point, or maybe there are some things that we can be doing more strategically or explicitly during our time spent planning and implementing our lessons. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. So here's what I want to accomplish in this session with everybody. So let's see if we can first build an understanding, or maybe a more, you know, practical understanding of the effective math teaching practices that come from NCTM's principles to actions in action. The second thing is I want to make sure that we develop an awareness of 5 formative assessment techniques to inform and improve daily teaching and learning. Third thing is I want to develop or deepen an understanding of a framework for orchestrating productive discussions, and that's the framework by Smith and Stein. So for any of you guys that are 5 practices fans like me, that's a framework that's rooted in student thinking and closely aligned with the effective math teaching practices. I also want to examine practice, and I say practice in quotes because we are doing this online. But I will have you imagine using a tool and go through some of the steps of using a tool to assist with planning for and monitoring the use of formative assessment techniques. And finally, I want you to go away considering a plan for implementing these practices, these techniques, and teacher moves in maybe your own math classrooms or your own leadership practice. Does that sound good? All right. So as mentioned, a portion of tonight's session is based on the collaborative work of many who I'm proud to call my friends and colleagues. And first, the Drs. Skip Fennell and also Dr. Beth Cabet, who probably need no introduction to people on this webinar. And I collaborated on this resource called the Formative 5 Everyday Assessment Techniques for Every Math Classroom, which was published by Corwin in early 2017. What you need to know about this resource is our efforts for the past couple of years and even the time leading up to the book have been dedicated to addressing the important role of formative assessment and its everyday connection to planning and instruction. Our analysis, however, revealed that we actually know a lot about formative assessment, and we actually know that it can and does make a difference. Like, in fact, it's been part of the education research base for at least 70 years. We've also found that when we ask educators about formative assessment, we receive many different responses and definitions. So let's focus on one tonight that maybe I think we would all probably agree on. The researchers Black and William in 1998 defined formative assessment as encompassing all those activities undertaken by teachers and or by their students, which provide information to be used as feedback to modify the teaching and learning activities in which they are engaged. So far too many teachers still indicate that assessment to them is like some sort of unique moment, often defined by others as end of the year external assessments, like summative assessments, state mandated assessments, PARC, Smarter Balance, other things like that, rather than regularly connected to their planning and teaching. And finally, the three of us have recognized an overload of commercial resources, actually published formative assessments you can even buy in the form of worksheets and services advertised as the formative assessment fix for the classroom. So together, we distilled a collection of five practical and effective techniques that I'll briefly discuss tonight and actually connect well with these other frameworks. Now, one of my favorite publications that is, as of this past spring, is in its second edition, and it's Peg Smith and Mary Kay Stein's Five Practices for Orchestrating Productive Math Discussions. It's been an absolute gem for me and many of my colleagues in Howard County. These practices have truly changed the way in which we think about planning and almost redefined our entire outlook on the role of the teacher during lessons in Howard County. So we'll delve into the five practices tonight, and I'll share some of the work that has been going on in my district over the past couple of years, as well as the future directions that we are aiming toward as a result of the ideas shared in this book. And then this publication, and in many ways, it's really a giant position statement of the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, Principles to Actions, Ensuring Mathematical Success for All, came out in 2014. There have been several spin-off publications that have come out that have focused on each of the essential elements. So we know there's a lot of work around the effective mathematics teaching practices. We know that there's a lot of work coming out around access and equity and curriculum and assessment, et cetera. So I should note that if you weren't aware, Peg Smith and Mary Kay Stein are largely responsible for the research that resulted in NCTM's 8 effective math teaching practices. In my district, we're absolutely obsessed with ensuring that 100% of our teachers are planning for and implementing them every lesson, every day. Okay, we even conduct collaborative classroom visits where each of the members of my team partner and pair with administrators, mathematics coaches in the building, department heads in the middle and high schools, and we conduct what we call collaborative classroom visits. They're kind of like walkthroughs, but we spend time in each classroom teacher's classes, two periods, you know, per day during those walkthroughs. We're giving the teacher non-evaluative feedback in terms of evidence that we're seeing. We're giving the team feedback in terms of things that they're doing really well as a team, and then areas in which they can grow that are right in their zone of readiness. And we're even collecting data about the implementation of or teacher engagement with each of these 8 teaching practices. We've been looking at over the last 3 years, and that focus has really transformed many of our classrooms in a really, really positive way. So we're going to indirectly address all 8 of these in some way, shape, or form tonight, and specifically connect with at least the 5 highlighted on this slide, hence the subtitle brought to you by the number 5, if you already haven't picked up on that already. So I want to give you a few moments to read this quote, and I want to get some feedback from you. Take a moment to read it again, and this is the purpose that I want you to be reading it for. What do you think Smith and Stein are referring to when they mention the phrase, an unconnected series of show-and-tell demonstrations? Like, what does that look like in a classroom? And if you're willing, share your ideas in our chat space. These are really interesting, and you guys are hitting it right on the head. To be honest with you, you're describing me when I was in the classroom early in my career. So I mentioned the guide on the side, and that's what I tried to be every day. And in doing that, I thought my role was at some point in the lesson to get kids up in front of the room to share their work, their solutions, their thinking, etc. I gave very little thought to who I was selecting, which was oftentimes an access and equity issue. I gave very little thought to what I was actually looking for, especially during the planning phase, not to mention the fact that oftentimes I would select three or four students that would come up and show the identical solution. I'd usually follow up each of their presentations with some sort of compliment. Hey, that's really great work. Does anybody have any questions? Pause. I'd use the wait time. Usually there were really no questions. And then I'd follow up with the next student. And I felt really good about getting students up there and then pausing those very generic, in many ways, meaningless questions. At least they were meaningless to my students because my students weren't really responding. So in many ways, what I was doing was I was just implementing a show and tell routine. And so you might be thinking at this point, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, where's the formative assessment? And that's where I want to get into where there's the connection here. So whether or not you've read the formative five, I think you're all familiar with several of these techniques. In fact, some of these techniques were even alluded to in the responses in the opening question that you guys shared. I'm going to go into the details related to the use of observations and interviews a little bit later, but just know that the show me technique is when students are prompted by a teacher to share their thinking using a different or sometimes a specific representation. In other words, I might see that the student has shown me using an expression or equation. I might ask them, can you show me using a pictorial model or a picture or a drawing, or can you show me using some hands-on materials or tools or something like that? A hinge question, however, and this comes from the work of Dylan William, is a check for understanding at a hinge point in a lesson. So-called hinge because of the two interlinked meanings. First, it's posed at a point where you move from one key idea, activity, or point onto another. So it's done at a key time in the lesson. It can be done in the beginning, it can be done in the middle, it can be done towards the end, but it's a key time. It's almost like one of those deal breaker questions you pose. You're posing it to everybody. And in fact, the intention is not to get into a huge, lengthy discussion. The point is that understanding the content before the hinge is actually a prerequisite for being able to respond successfully. And when students have responded successfully, or even sometimes unsuccessfully, I as the teacher make some decisions about the direction in which I'm going to go and the follow-up that I need to do with certain students. And I don't think the use of exit tasks really needs much of an explanation as long as we remember to ensure that the task is meaningful, it's rigorous, and informs planning and decision-making for the next day's lesson. And so tonight, we're going to focus mostly on the intentional and explicit use of planned observations, interviews, and show me opportunities as we consider how to improve our work with leading productive math conversations in our classroom. In other words, we're going to consider how and what we can do when observing students engaged in problem solving or task work, and also how we can engage students in productive math discussions and thinking through the use of planned, purposeful questions and interviews. So one of the five formative techniques, observation, as reported by teachers, is used to inform instruction throughout virtually every single lesson. In fact, I've heard teachers say that, you know, when kids are engaged in collaborative task work, they're observing anywhere from 50 to 100% of that period. In fact, we've known for at least 45 years that it is even more informative to observe a student during a math activity than it is to grade his papers. However, although teachers state that they've always used observation, they view it as the least formal of the techniques or haven't viewed it as a formative assessment technique at all. Many indicate that they need support to use observations to explicitly guide and inform their instructional decisions. in many cases, I think observations is the starting point for most teachers in terms of the techniques that they use. However, in my own observations of the actions of some teachers, and this is while kids are engaged in collaborative problem solving, they're often monitoring on-task social behaviors, serving as a timekeeper, and at times even posing the same repetitive and generic questions to students and student groups, which should really not be their main roles. And I've owned this in my own district as we have really focused on the need to better support teachers through focused professional learning around this. So one of the things that I've become also concerned about is the way in which we capture critical data through the observation of student work. By that, what I mean is their written and verbal representations, like their actions, their models, their attempts and solutions, even their mistakes or unique approaches, and even their discussions. Oftentimes I see a teacher carefully monitoring, but without even capturing or recording it anywhere except mentally. And I've yet to run into teachers that have, you know, a photographic memory. And at the secondary level, teachers are teaching sometimes anywhere from, you know, 100 to 150 students throughout the day. So with that sheer number of students and the beautiful ideas that come up throughout problem-solving opportunities in the classroom, all this critical, this formative information seems to get lost. So pictured here is a middle school math teacher in my district. His name's Brian Geiselman. He's beginning his second year in Howard County. And one of the smartest investments he made early in his career is actually pictured in this picture. I wonder if you know what it is. It's not his clothing. It's actually the $1.88 purchase of a clipboard from his local Walmart. So Brian's doing some very important work in this scene. And I should say he's actually done some important work prior to this scene. And I want to pause this scene because I want to do a little bit of math and I want to set this up with you tonight. So we're going to pause this scene. We're going to come back to it. And we're going to discuss a problem that Brian and his students are solving. So here it is. So let's do some math together. And we're going to focus on something non-volatile such as politics. Let's talk about our Supreme Court, which resides just 45 minutes down the road from where I'm leading this webinar. I think I have this picture right. I think Anthony Kennedy has retired and he's going to be replaced. I think there's someone named Kavanaugh who they're looking at right now, but has not been confirmed yet. Anyway, so just know that there are 9 Supreme Court justices. And since all the way back to about the 1800s, it's been traditional for justices to wear black robes while in the court. That's one tradition. Another tradition you may or may not be aware of is that quill pens have remained a part of the courtroom scene, which kind of blew my mind. White quills are placed on the counsel tables each day that the court sits, as was done at the earliest sessions of the court. And if you're an attorney that presents Supreme Court, they even let you take a memento home with you. They give you a quill pen. So the Supreme Court also has a traditional seal, which is similar to the Great Seal of the United States, but it has a single star beneath the Eagle's Claws, symbolizing the Constitution's creation of one Supreme Court. Now, another tradition is the judicial handshake. And I'm serious about it. This is real. It's been a tradition since the days of Chief Justice Melville Fuller in the late 19th century. And to this day, the tradition goes like this. When the justices assemble to go onto the bench and at the beginning of the private conferences at which they discuss decisions, each justice shakes hands with each of the other 8. Chief Justice Fuller instituted the practice as a reminder that differences of opinion on the court did not preclude the overall harmony of purpose of the court. So just imagine us taking a look at this task. And this was the task that Brian and his students were looking at. It goes like this. If each justice shakes hands exactly once with each of the other justices, how many total handshakes take place? Could you solve that in as many ways as you can? And secondly, can you develop a rule for finding the number of handshakes for any size group? So in other words, if we had 100 people in a group or 1,000 people in a group or 10,500 in a group, how many handshakes would take place if everybody shook hands exactly once with each other person, right? you might want to begin solving that if you want to, or just kind of listening. But we're going to get to that today. But I want to go back to Brian. One of the things that Brian was actually doing, and what he was doing prior to using the tool on his clipboard, is he was considering his ideas around these factors. In other words, during the planning phase of Brian's lesson, he considered several things. Number one, what is it that I hope to observe my students doing in this math lesson? That's called anticipating. Second thing is, how will I know it if I see it or observe it? And how will I record what I observe? And the formative five and five practices have some suggestions for this. Okay, the formative five, I know, is chock full of tools that, you know, look for tools, planning tools, observation tools, reflection tools that can help with this. I'll show you one that we've kind of adapted from both the formative five and the five practices tonight. Also, Brian's asking, are there particularly unique or advanced representations and or solutions, even errors or misconceptions that I might observe? And finally, he's asking himself during planning, how will I assess and respond to and even help advance student thinking with meaningful feedback, but without doing the math for my students, okay? Or even like, you know, funneling their thinking. And here's where I hope you'll begin to see the connections between these techniques and framework and practices. So for those of you guys that are big fans, or those of you guys that have maybe just heard of the five practices, here's a brief review. Smith and Stein's five practices were actually designed to help teachers use students' responses to advance the math understanding of the class as a whole by providing teachers with some control over what is likely to happen in the discussion, as well as more time to make instructional decisions by shifting some of the decision-making to the planning phase of the lesson. Here's what I mean. Five practices are, and this is during planning, anticipating the likely student responses, the likely student solutions, the likely student solution pathways, and even some of the mistakes or misconceptions to challenging tasks during that planning phase, okay? And then we're in the action phase. So now we're in the lesson, and we're monitoring students' responses to the task. And in many ways, what we're doing is we're adding to that anticipation that took place during the planning phase, because we're seeing kids do things that maybe we never thought they would use, or we never even imagined they could come up with, okay? Then what we're doing is, as we're monitoring, we're beginning to distill out some of the patterns that we're seeing in our student work. And we're starting to select particular students who represent the representations, the solutions, some of even the misconceptions or mistakes that are present, to lead a student share out, okay, or a whole group discussion. Okay, that's going to take place at a certain point in this lesson. But what I think becomes really world-class about this process is that we're not only selecting students for various reasons, we're actually sequencing the order in which the student responses will be displayed. And that's really important, because when we acknowledge that, you know, students solve things differently, and not every student solves it the way that other students do. However, as a teacher, we're selecting students, you know, to get up. Maybe the first student is the student that, you know, has a representation that is the most accessible for that class. In other words, it's the representation that maybe most of the students accessed as they started working on the solution for that problem. That's really, really important. Okay, having them go first and then selecting a student with a representation or a solution that maybe connects to that, okay, pretty well, is a great sort of second student to choose, and then third and fourth and so on. And when we develop a trajectory like that, we might not have all solved the problem in that way, but we leave with a really, really decent understanding of the story behind this problem and the story behind our solutions across the entire group. Now, connecting is really, really difficult, we found. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later in my talk tonight, but connecting is where we're actually having discussions about different students' ideas in response to key responses to questions that we've posed and presented. And we're really, in many ways, what we're trying to do is we're trying to connect those representations, which is what mathematics is really all about. So now you can see a larger portion of the classroom scene playing out in Brian's classroom. Brian's actually engaged in the monitoring phase right now. And while students are working on the task in small groups, he's keying in on what he's observing. And he's noting, you know, several things. And I want to show you the tool that Brian actually is using in that scene. It might be a little hard for you to read, so I'll just talk you through this. Three columns. Essentially, the first column is where he's anticipating the likely responses to that problem, okay, during planning. And then he's also adding those representations or solutions that he's seeing during the monitoring phase, okay? In the second column, it's pretty simple. He's listing who's doing, okay, those things. In other words, who might be using a table, okay? Or maybe it's a tree diagram, or maybe some sort of picture with dots connected and line segments connecting those dots, okay? And he's often at times also writing down some notes about what he's seeing that different students are using. So a lot of students' names will pop in here. When I've done this before in classrooms, I've found that it takes me about 3 or 4 laps around the classroom where I'm really keying in on what students are saying and doing and writing and their actions and modeling. But I have a really decent picture of who's doing what by the time I've taken those, you know, 3 or 4 slow laps. And then finally, in the third column, he's using simply ordinal numbers. So K5 people, what are ordinal numbers? They're numbers like first and second, third and fourth. He's making decisions about not just who, but in what order he wants students to present their work during the whole group discussion. So he's sequencing the order of student presentations prior to the student share out. Now, I put a URL where you can download this, and you'll notice even in the bottom left-hand corner, each of the 5 practices are there as a reminder for the teacher. And then there's some talk moves I'll talk about a little bit later. But I have to pause the action right now because all this sounds great, but I have to assure you that this has not been easy work, okay? At least it hasn't been easy work in my district. And so here's where I have to pause, because this goes back to my classroom, okay, when I started teaching. Perhaps the oldest and still most common form of teacher questioning is what is up on the screen here. It's commonly referred to as the IRE pattern, in which the teacher initiates a question, the student or students respond, usually in 1 or 2 words, and the teacher evaluates the student's response as either right or wrong. Okay, well, again, this was my approach a lot when I was a full-time classroom teacher. And yet this is a pervasive pattern that still exists in many math classrooms. And so one of the roadblocks that we found in Howard County was that even with this great tool, as recent as last school year, we were kind of, we were crashing and burning sometimes. And we realized that we weren't spending enough time on one of the factors associated with planning. And that was planning for and being ready to pose those purposeful questions. In other words, AKA, engage in interviews and show me prompts at the right time and under the right conditions with our students. So we studied NCTM's Taking Action books that came out 2 summers ago now. They're available in grade bands, K5, 6, 8, 9 to 12. We bought them for all of our 6, 8, 9, 12 teachers. And those books reintroduce us to Smith and Stein's work around questioning techniques. We considered the importance of developing assessing questions, which in a nutshell help teachers be able to clarify what the student has done, and also advancing questions, which are designed to move the student beyond what they've done, even help move a student's thinking forward, but without funneling their thinking or even doing the math for them. Now, the interesting thing was, unbeknownst to us, Peg Smith and Mary Kay Stein had already worked on this challenge and developed a similar tool. And this is in their second edition of their book that I said came out this spring. And it looks very similar to this one. We've adapted it a little bit, but essentially you have the same 3 columns, okay? if you look in the first column, you still have the let's anticipate the likely responses to a challenging task or problem. Let's list them there during planning. And then while we're monitoring student work, we're going to add any that we didn't anticipate. And still in the second to last column over there on the right, you still have the who and the what. Names of students corresponding with strategies or representations observed or monitored during the task across that row. And you still have in the final column that sequence, that sequencing or ordering as we prepare for our whole group discussion. But what was really, really great was the work they did in adding the assessing questions and advancing questions as a planning routine. What I mean with that is, imagine that we anticipate certain representations or strategies, okay, to a rich mathematical problem. But during the planning phase, we come up with various assessing questions that align with those with a specific representation, okay, or solution pathway, or even a specific advancing question or questions that would intend to help move a student's thinking forward. Maybe they're stuck, okay, or explore the underlying concept more deeply than they have. Imagine being armed with that, having our $1.88 clipboard for Walmart and walking around with that. And as we're monitoring student work and we're listening to their discussions and we're watching them engage in various representations, imagine we're able to pose those questions that are connected with their specific representations that we're working on. And then even imagine during the connecting phase. So when students are sharing their work and I've selected kids to go up and share their work, imagine I've got these really, really important questions that I can pose that are connected with the representations they're sharing. I think that's a world-class practice in my book, at least. So you may have already begun solving the judicial handshake problem. Normally I'd want us to work individually and then in pairs or small groups. Let's spend some time kind of looking at that problem a little bit, and maybe you might want to try your hand at solving it a little bit if you haven't already done that. And what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to type any of your anticipations in the chat area. In other words, which representations and or solutions, and they could be correct or partially correct or incorrect, might you anticipate students could use to find or the solution to the problem? And whenever you're ready, I'd love it if you could share these in our chat space. And I'll pause a little bit. These are great. So you're right. They might just start out of the gates with 8x7, like Jane said. Okay, so Robert's got, n times quantity, n minus one is incorrect, but it's very common when kids, when kids encounter a problem like this. In many ways, they've almost been coached to use that expression. 9x8, sure. Right. Again, Jane, drawing a picture, maybe in a circle, maybe there's 9 dots around in a circle and we're connecting things like dots with line segments that represent a handshake. Right. And so they shake one hand, right? And that'd be a question, Rebecca, that kids may come up with. Do they shake both hands or is it just one hand, the right hand, the left hand? Patricia talks about an error where kids may count more than once the same handshake. Exactly. Mitch, love it. They might try to act out in their group. That'd be fantastic. Okay, I think we'd all love to see that in our math classrooms. Good. Janet agrees with that too. All right, these are great. Keep them coming. So I'd normally have you do this. I'd normally have us, if we were all in a room together, I'd have you solve that. I'd have you even list in the first column of this tool what you'd anticipate. And I think a good way to do that is, a good practice is every teacher should solve the challenging tasks that we're posing for our students. And I think we could come up with some interesting and also pretty typical strategies and representations that our students would come up with. And if we were to do this in a PLC, it would be even better, because I think more heads are better than one, and we'd come up with even more. And I'll bet you we'd be at least partially correct, you know, when we went into the classroom, when we monitored student work. We'd also see kids do some things that we didn't anticipate. And so we'd want to add those in that space, in that first column, all right? And then what we'd want to do next is we'd want to plan for discourse via purposeful questions. So we'd want to come up with some assessing questions or advancing questions. And I have some generic ones, like, and this isn't rocket science, but I realize this is some of the hard work. And these are some of the roadblocks that I think my teachers came up with, because we just never thought of spending a lot of our time here. And in fact, when I think about it now, I'm like, man, this is where we need to spend most of our time, I think. Here's a generic assessing question. What information are you given, and what are you asked to find? How are the numbers or quantities related? Is this like a problem you've seen before? You know, tell me more information like that. Can you try a specific number? Can you give me one example or a non-example? Or is there a hidden question you need to answer first? Those are like some generic ones. And in terms of advancing questions, well, some generic advancing questions might be, have you used all the important information that you're given? You might use a almost like a show me prompt. Can you show me an equation that goes with your drawing? Can you show me a picture to illustrate what you just told me? Okay, can you explain your work to another student or group? What I love about advancing questions is we can pose those to kids. We can listen to the response. We can even pose them to kids and pause and then tell kids, you know, we're gonna walk away and we're gonna come back and give them time to respond to that. And then come back later on and hear what they have to say. And, you know, I think what we find a lot of times is that question, I think, provides students with the think time they need to advance their thinking forward. And many times they're able to move on without us, without our assistance. And that's important. So here are some, I don't know if you can read these on your screen, but here are some specific assessing questions around each of these, you know, representations or strategies. And some of these are ones that you guys came up with in the chat space. So like, for instance, if a student used a table, we might ask, what does the value in each row represent in your table? And how does this information represent the total number of handshakes? And for students that came up with pictures, and I find with this problem, lots and lots of students and even adults use pictures. In many ways, it's the conceptual proof for why the expression or equation works. So it's really, really important that we value that representation. Here's one. How and why did you draw your picture? Does the picture give you enough information to help you represent the total number of handshakes? It might or might not. And then finally, with someone who used, and you guys came up with this, used the multiplication equation, like 9 times 8 equals 72. So how do you find your equation? And I want you to discuss that calculation that you did and why you did it with your partner or your partners, okay? When it comes to advancing questions, you might think that these are a little more generic. They don't have to be. I mean, you could say, can you act that scenario out to check the accuracy of your equation? So that's pretty specific when we look down at that latter example down at the bottom. But there are some ones that are pretty general. And I think that we can get pretty good at coming up with these advancing questions the more and more we practice using a tool like this. So I've listed some of those there. And we don't have to come up with multiple ones. Sometimes it's just one, you know, per representation that we just want to have in our hip pocket and make ready whenever we need to use it. So the who and the what, I want to remind you that takes place during the monitoring phase, but then also on my particular example right here, I've written in the names of students. So I wasn't trying to take the easy way out by writing down groups, but a lot of times when groups are working collaboratively and maybe we've even like assigned group roles and maybe there's a recorder in the group, a lot of times when we do that, it makes it a little bit easier to to capture what groups are doing. Okay, in this case, it was really important that I indicated which group was doing what, but also really, really important that I selected a particular spokesperson or leader. And like I said earlier, there may be some access and equity issues around why decisions I make around that. And one of the things that I've seen that's been pretty neat in practice is for kids that maybe are hesitant about getting up and sharing, I've seen where teachers have taken something like a post-it note, and they've as they've circulated and watched students working, they've written on the post-it note like Jada's name and said, Jada, you're going to go, let's say, second. Okay, you're going to be the second person to share. And what I really want you to talk about is the thinking that went into your table. So if Jada and her group came up with three or four different representations, Jada knows we're just going to focus on the table. We've told her she's going to be going second. Okay. And she knows that she can sort of like prepare a little bit, and she'll pay attention to who goes first. And maybe Jada will come up to bat with some ideas about how that table connects with the representation that was selected to go first, which in this case, there's no right or wrong, to this, but I think that a teacher can obviously use his or her own professional judgment to justify why they would choose maybe the picture first. Maybe the picture, like I said, was the representation used by the most students in the class, followed by, Jada's table and group two's table, which if we had time would be followed by Michelle's group's addition expression over there. And then we would finish, if we had time, with Kenyon's group four's multiplication equation. The whole time we would have these questions, assessing questions that we could pose to connect the representation. And I'll tell you, one really good assessing question is just, once the second person shares, asking the question, hey, Jada, how does your table connect with Devin's picture? I think that's a really, really important question that we need to revisit time after time after time throughout these group discussions. So I'm going to pause right now and answer some questions. I'd love to hear what you're thinking right now. So Jessica, I don't know if you've caught some questions. I'm looking at the chat, but I'm happy to answer any. Rebecca has a question. Oh, okay, for Mitch. Okay, all right, well, let's move on then. In that earlier look for tool, in the bottom right-hand corner, there was a section called Five Talk Moves to Guide Discussion and Ensure Student Accountability. This, again, comes from the work of Smith and Stein. What I really like about this is, a lot of teachers that try these techniques for the first time, or maybe are using a task for the first time, might not have spent that much time with the task or even the content. So coming up with questions can be kind of tough. The other thing is, we do have to build a culture where students become comfortable and understand it's not just an expectation, it's their responsibility to engage in productive discourse. And so there are ways in which we can do that through each of these five techniques. Again, they're called five talk moves. And the one up there about revoicing is simply, we're actively listening. And you as a teacher might pose that, but I think it's perfectly acceptable for a student to pose that to another student. So what you're saying is that, such and such and such, is that what you mean? What I love about that is it's very respectful, and it gives the student that's been sharing their ideas the opportunity to listen to somebody summarize or paraphrase what they just heard, and then make a judgment about whether or not that's actually what they meant. And so I love that one. Another one is just asking students to restate someone else's reasoning, and that can be an accountability thing. But again, I think it's really, really important that we're doing that. Because oftentimes, I know a lot of times I'll share something, and when somebody restates it and I hear it, I go, that is exactly what I said, and that is not at all what I meant. So again, it's another respectful, I think, prompt. Asking students to apply their own reasoning to someone else's reasoning. Do you agree with Jada? Why or why not? prompting students for further participation. So does anyone else have any other thoughts or comments? And using wait time. Wait time for a couple reasons. One, to allow students to compose their thoughts and recognize that deep mathematical thinking takes time. That's really, really important. And we want to make sure that's a value in all of our classrooms. And also, wait time can be used to signify that, you know, maybe we've come to it to the end of a particular discussion and it's time to move on. So I'm going to use that wait time right now and move to my last slide. So with the remaining time, I'm here to answer any of your questions that you might have, but I'm also interested in your thoughts at this point. Do you see any benefits of incorporating some or all of these techniques, practices, tools, and moves in your own practice, okay, or your own work around leadership or professional learning? And if so, I'd love to know what your next steps are. I'd love it if you'd share your ideas or even questions in our chat area right now. So I'd love to hear, what are your next steps? What are your next moves? What are you thinking right now? Heather asked the question, I love these ideas. I also love asking questions to which I do not yet know the answer. I teach high school. What are your thoughts on that? I have to be completely honest. It wasn't even high school. It was when I was teaching fifth grade in elementary school where I would pose some questions. I would even pose some problems that I wasn't super solid on in terms of even understanding the meaning behind the mathematics. I got used to doing that after a while because what I realized was when I gave students the opportunity to solve the problems and work collaboratively, and when I engaged them in, conversations that were whole group and sharing their work, what I found was that eventually we found solutions that made sense for the class. I think now if I went back and I used these techniques explicitly during planning and the implementation of my lessons, I feel even better about posing questions that I don't necessarily know all the answers to. Okay. And I think it's okay to be transparent with kids and say, you know what, I'm going to pose a question I don't even know the answer to. I think for some kids, that's really engaging for them. Okay, love the things you guys are coming up with.
There's a question in there from N. Bicknell. The task you select is critical. Is there a strategy you use to develop tasks?
Yeah, actually, yes. It's I primarily, my first strategy is not to develop a task of my own. I think, and Diane Breyer, she's a past president of NCTM. I worked alongside her when I served on the board. One of the things that I heard her say over and over again was there are.
Uh-oh. Hello? Hello, hello? John, I think we lost you. Sorry, everybody. Looks like we lost John right there at the end. So hopefully you can hear me okay. Okay. Hopefully he'll come back. Oh, there you are. Hello?
All right. Can you hear me now?
Yes, there you go. Okay.
Okay, so just in response to that, that's a great question. I was saying Diane Breyers, who's the past president of NCTM, used to always say to me, there are so many awesome resources out there. And now there's so much on the web. And these are reputable, sites out there. Like, I love some of the old stuff from the Mars Tasks and the illustrative math stuff that's been out. for years and years and years. Now they even have a curriculum. But even stuff like openmiddle.com, if you've ever used open middle problems, I know Dan Meyer came up with this, and a whole group of great folks created a repository of great problems. Those are the ones I'd go with. I wouldn't try to develop problems or tasks on my own as a common practice. I mean, I think there's some value in doing that, but there's so much great stuff out there. I'd spend most of my time around the planning phase thinking about what I'd anticipate, and then also coming up with assessing and advancing questions. That's just my opinion.
There was another one in there from Cindy Farmer. She said, how can she purposefully and respectfully share this with her math team?
And just go for it. There's a handout, I think, that I put in here. If you guys click on the handout link up above the chat window, you'll see a Microsoft Word version of the 5 practices observation tool that we adapted from Stein and Smith. I'd say download it and make it your own. Make sure you credit them, though, and try it out. Go for it.
All right. I think we may have gotten all the questions. Janet made a good point. I'm going to jump in here really quick. She said, do not just use problems that students can just look up on Google, which for me personally, I'm fine if they can look it up on Google, because then it forces them to be able to explain how to solve it, right? It's the same way as those conversations that you've had with kids. If you give them a problem and here's the answer and I need you to explain how to solve it. But in the case of trying to make sure they understand and you get good discussions, obviously you wouldn't want them to be able to Google it. But
yeah. James in the Q&A thing, he makes a really good point. James, I agree with you. I think the observation tool can be used for a lot of different things. It can be used for monitoring common errors. I agree. It can be used even with solving this is my favorite thing, but you know, sometimes kids need to practice. And so if kids are doing practice problems or I'd call them exercises. I don't have time to go into the difference there, but I think the tool can be used, and maybe we're focusing in on key problems or exercises, and they're almost like our deal breaker ones where there's still some rigor in those exercises, but maybe we're looking for whether or not students are solving it correctly, using a reasonable thinking process, whether it's different from their. I don't think that matters.
Hey, Ben, how are you?
I think we can do that. We can definitely do that. And the tool can be used that way. All right. I don't see anything else up here. You guys have my email address. Sorry, I just lost everybody. You guys have my contact information. Feel free to reach out if you have any additional questions or you just have some ideas that you'd love to share with me. I'd love to hear about them. Thanks, everybody.